The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Huntington USA and others versus Blazers Wholesale Distributors Incorporated from Dallas County and the 5th Judicial Appellate District, which is consolidated for oral argument with an original mandamus proceeding in Ray Huntington USA and others. Honda Motor Company Limited and others versus Hippolito Ramos Sanchez and others, well, and his wife on behalf of the estate of Hermes Hippolito Ramos Galvan from Cameron County and the 13th Appellate District. And finally, In Re Bridgestone Firestone Incorporated, an original mandamus proceeding. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for petitioners or relators to present their argument and for the respondents to, or dual parties to reply. The petitioners or relators may reserve a portion of that 20 minutes for rebuttal by advising our marshal in advance. These arguments are all being recorded by the clerk of our court, and you may purchase a tape of an argument for a nominal fee from the clerk's office. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and conclude these arguments before our lunch break. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners and relators in Huntington.
May I please report, Mr. Thomas Hungar will present argument for the relators. The relators have reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please the court. With me at council table is my co-counsel, Mr. Ray Rodriguez. Pursuant to the broad grant of legislative authority in Article 16, Section 20 of the Texas Constitution, the Texas Legislature has established a comprehensive regulatory scheme to govern the alcoholic beverage industry in the state. As part of that regulatory scheme, the Beer Industry Fair Dealing Law in Section 102.77 specifies statutory requirements for termination of distributorship arrangements and mandates an arbitration mechanism for resolution of disputes over those statutory requirements at the option of either party. Notwithstanding the legislature's broad grant of authority, the Constitution's broad grant of authority to the legislature to legislate in this area, the Court of Appeals held that Section 102.77 and its arbitration mechanism in particular violate the Judicial Powers Clause of the Texas Constitution, Article 5, Section 1.
If, in fact, the statutory cause of action displaced the common law breach of contract cause of action, would you think there'd be a violation of the Judicial Powers Clause?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, although, of course, that question, in our view, is not presented here because the common law cause of action is not displaced.
But presume that it were.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the proper analysis would be under the Open Courts Clause. And under the Open Courts Clause, if indeed it did displace and abrogate the common law cause of action, then the first of the two elements of the Open Courts claim would have been established. And the inquiry would then need to proceed to the next step, which is to look at whether the abrogation is reasonable in light of the alternative remedy provided and the purposes of the statute and the law.
But under our law, it probably would be a violation of open courts then, if you presume that it displaces the common law breach of contract cause of action.
Well, I don't believe so, Your Honor. There are, for instance, in the workers' compensation area, I believe the common law cause of action in tort has been displaced by the workers' compensation statute.
And but there are avenues for review. There are all sorts of avenues for substantial evidence review and administrative proceedings and different levels of review, which this statute would not then afford if it does displace the common law.
Well, this statute does afford avenues for review, although they are not they are somewhat more limited than the avenues for review in the workers' compensation scheme or in the administrative procedure scheme generally. But I guess what I'd say is it's not clear to me that it would violate the Constitution because the Judicial Powers Clause, because it would be a statutory issue that was being resolved, whether it's by an arbitral, non-judicial tribunal or an administrative non-judicial tribunal, the offense to the separation of powers, if there is one, is the same in either category. And indeed, arguably, it would be worse to, it is worse to assign particular issues to an administrative tribunal, which is a part of the executive branch, and the purpose of the separation of powers doctrine is to guard against one branch arrogating to itself powers that rightly belong to another.
Well, let me just rewind for a minute, and I realize that you say there will be something still left of a common law contract claim, and I'd like to know what that would look like.
Well, a contract between a distributor and a manufacturer could have any number of contractual terms that would be enforceable in a normal breach of contract action that would not be statutory requirement.
In this case, what would be left of, if the contract claim goes to arbitration, the statutory contract claim goes to arbitration, what's left of a common law contract claim?
Well, to the extent that respondent is arguing the good cause issue, it's not clear. I guess it depends on how the arbitration proceeding winds up, what the nature of the resolution of the arbitration proceeding is. But the fact that respondent happens to have incorporated, the parties happen to have incorporated the terms of the statute into the contract doesn't somehow turn this into the abrogation of a common law claim. The good cause requirement of the statute.
That's where I keep going in circles, because on trying to figure out what would be left of a common law contract claim, because statute requires that good cause be put into the contract, and that's the measure under the statute, which you don't have under the common law. And so it's hard for me to see where the abrogation of common law would come from or not. I mean, it's a circular analysis.
Well, it's important to look at what the common law cause of action for breach of contract is, what it embodies. It does not embody. There is no good cause requirement in the common law.
No, I understand that, but the statute requires that the contracts have good cause, so you catch yourself coming and going.
But it's a statutory requirement, and therefore it is entirely appropriate for the legislature to assign the resolution of that requirement to a non-judicial tribunal. It's just like in the Subaru and Bootleru cases, which this court decided earlier this year, that there was a common law cause of action at issue in those cases. In the Subaru case, for instance, it was a breach of oral contract. But one of the elements, as it happened on the particular facts of that case, one of the issues that was an element of the claim was one that was assigned to the exclusive jurisdiction of the Motor Vehicle Board. And this court said there was no problem with doing that. It was entirely appropriate for the legislature to have assigned that statutory issue to be resolved by the non-judicial
tribunal. Under a primary jurisdiction theory, which is quite different from what we have here.
Well, originally primary, but then on rehearing, exclusive jurisdiction because of the legislative change. Yes, Your Honor. But the point is, there was no constitutional offense, and indeed, it was not even a restriction of a common law claim, the court said, for an issue to be resolved by an administrative tribunal, even though the resolution of that issue would then have an effect on the subsequent judicial consideration of the common law claim. Precisely the same thing is happening here, to the extent that there might be some sort of preclusive effect, and again, that's entirely speculative at this point. But even if there would be, Subaru indicates that that is not the abrogation of a common law claim. It's simply a statutorily assigned non-judicial tribunal doing its job in accordance with the statute, resolving the statutory issue. And then the court will resolve the common law issue, the common law claim, and take into account, to the extent there's a relevant statutory issue that has been previously resolved, taking account of that. That's not, under Subaru and Boothroyd, that is not the abrogation of a common law claim. By the same token, what the legislature has done here is not the abrogation of the common law claim.
But in Subaru, there could be judicial review of that administrative finding. What is the judicial review here in this arbitration?
The judicial review is available under the General Arbitration Act and the common law, and judicial review is available on a number of grounds to challenge bias in the arbitrators, to challenge the failure to consider material evidence, to challenge the fairness or lack thereof in the procedures.
But you admit that's a very limited review.
It is limited, yes, Your Honor, and admittedly more limited than in the administrative context, but it is not non-existent. For manifest error of law or fact, the courts can and do set aside arbitral decisions.
What is the applicable arbitration statute?
The general Arbitration Act.
So only the Texas statute applies in this case?
Well, I think the answer to that question if you're, with respect to whether the Federal Arbitration
yes.
Act, yes. Clearly, under the Beer Industry Fair Dealing Law, it specifically provides that the General Arbitration Act, the Texas statute, applies. We have argued and believe that an appropriate ground for resolving this case would be for the court to conclude, as the trial court implicitly did, that the parties entered into a binding arbitration agreement because they specifically incorporated the terms of the law. And if that is true, if the court agrees with our submission in that regard, then I think the Federal Arbitration Act would also be applicable because the Federal Arbitration Act applies to agreements to arbitrate. So if the court agrees with our argument that by specifically incorporating the applicable law, including the arbitration mechanism, the parties have agreed to arbitrate, then it follows that the Federal Arbitration
Act. They didn't have any choice.
Well, they didn't have to specifically say in their contractual agreement.
No, but they didn't have any choice. They had to incorporate the statute into the agreement, otherwise it was void. I mean, to say that the parties contracted when the legislature has dictated what the terms of the contract must be and what a breach of the contract would be under the law is a little bit different than parties freely contracting.
It is a little bit different, but I don't believe the statute requires the parties to say in their agreement, oh, and by the way, the provision of this termination clause shall be subject to these
I understand,
measures.
But the Arbitration Act then also allows one party to invoke arbitration, which is different than an agreement to arbitrate where both parties would agree that the case would be submitted to arbitration.
Yes, that's true.
So now we have one party being able to invoke arbitration.
Under the statute, that's right.
Does that make any difference with respect to the application of the federal law to this case?
Well, again, I mean, I think it depends on the court's resolution of this antecedent question about whether this is viewed as an agreement to arbitrate or not. If there's a strong presumption in favor of finding agreements to arbitrate, as this court's cases have frequently said, and the law is that if it can reasonably be construed either way, any doubt will be resolved in favor of finding an agreement to arbitrate. And for those reasons, we think that it's appropriate to find one here.
Is there a way, though, to analyze this issue in which the legislature would dictate that this statutory claim would be arbitrated under the Texas Act that would not be construed as an agreement to arbitrate to bring into play the federal act?
Yes, I think that, and certainly that's how the Court of Appeals interpreted it. If this court concludes that by incorporating the terms of the statute into their agreement, by specifically and expressly incorporating them, even though they weren't required to go that far, the parties did not thereby have a meeting of minds and sort of form a separate contractual agreement, that essentially the force of the provisions in the termination clause is solely derived from the statute and not from the parties' agreement, then the Federal Arbitration Act would not apply. I think it's also important to note that if that's true for the arbitration mechanism, if the parties aren't deemed to have had a meeting of the minds and agreed contractually to arbitrate, even though they said it in their contract, because after all it was required by the statute. The same is true for the good cause requirement. We can't very well say, as Glazer's does, the good cause requirement has separate contractual force above and beyond the statute, but the arbitration mechanism doesn't. It seems to me it has to be the one or the other. And so either way you look at it, either the parties have agreed to arbitrate by incorporating the arbitration mechanism, in which case there's no constitutional issue, or the parties haven't agreed to arbitrate, they've just acknowledged the application of the statute, but that's also true for the good cause requirement, which so the only source of law of the good cause requirement, again, is the statute. It's not the common law. And so there's no
Is there any right to interlocutory appeal from the order by the trial court to arbitrate under the Texas Act?
No, there's not.
Then is there a right to mandamus relief off that order?
We don't believe so, Your Honor, because
why is that?
In this case, the court did not order the entire case to arbitration, only the discrete statutory issues in accordance with the Act. And the rest of the case, the common law claims, remain pending in the trial court. In our view, Glazer's had an adequate remedy at law by way of the normal route for challenging an arbitration award, which is they can file a motion. May I?
Yes, please.
They can file a motion to vacate and then obtain subsequent appellate review. There's no reason why that is not adequate. The Freis case is not applicable here because in that case, the analogy to the federal court appellate review was required the same result here.
If all that's true, how do we reach the substance of the arguments on the Judicial Powers Act?
Well, this is an alternative ground for reversal, Your Honor, and I think that's right. If the court concludes that there was no basis for a mandamus review, then the proper result would simply be to set aside the judgment below and not go any further.
Let me get this straight. If the following up on the last two sets of questions, if the parties have not made an agreement to arbitrate based on their contract, then only the Texas Arbitration Act applies.
Correct.
And so you have your petition for review is without merit here. You're proceeding solely on a mandamus at that point, correct?
Well, we have a jurisdictional argument in favor of the petition for review as well, because under the Texas Act, orders denying motions to compel arbitration are appealable as on an interlocutory basis.
Is there anything in the statute that suggests that applies to an appellate order as well as a trial court order?
It doesn't.
Or that it conceives of jurisdiction being conferred on our court as opposed to the intermediate courts of appeals through that statute?
It does not specifically say that, Your Honor. So the argument is by analogy, in essence, that in effect, and in terms of the practical effect of what the Court of Appeals has done, it has converted this to a case in which the motion to compel arbitration was denied, thereby making it subject to interlocutory.
But the Court of Appeals in that instance would not have had jurisdiction in the first place, because the appeal out of the trial court would have been from an order compelling arbitration.
Well, but because...
So I don't know how you'd ever get... How would you ever get to the second step? If the court asserted interlocutory appellate jurisdiction over an order compelling arbitration that it didn't have, then doesn't that make that order void, which would mean it should just be vacated?
Well, again, that may be, Your Honor, in which case mandamus review obviously is appropriate under this court's precedence.
But just to vacate it for want of jurisdiction?
Well, if the court concludes that there was no mandamus jurisdiction.
Yes. I understand that. I understand that. Okay.
Yes. What of the merits would we reach under that if we pursued that avenue?
Well, if you concluded that there was no mandamus jurisdiction, I think you would not... It seems to me you would not reach the merits at all. It would simply be a matter of determining that the Court of Appeals lacked jurisdiction to proceed and vacating its judgment.
Do you think we have mandamus jurisdiction? Assuming that we say that the Texas Act applies, there's no interlocutory appeal, CA did not have jurisdiction, do we have mandamus jurisdiction to reach the merits?
I would think you would. In effect, the situation we have here is that absent action by this court, petitioners and relators will be denied their right, certainly a statutory right, and we believe also a contractual right, to arbitrate. And this court has repeatedly said it.
So we would say, we would hold, if we were to follow this line, the CA had no jurisdiction over interlocutory appeal. And we say that then the question becomes, could the Court of Appeals address this question by mandamus, the merits of it? And should they have, if they should have, we should. And I'm just getting at, why do appellate courts have or do not have mandamus jurisdiction to look at the merits?
Well, I guess if this court certainly has mandamus jurisdiction to reach the issues, and it may be that if the court concludes that Court of Appeals...
why do we have mandamus jurisdiction? Or why did the Court of Appeals... I mean, I think that's what Justice Olin and I are both getting at. Why would the Court of Appeals have mandamus jurisdiction? It would be able to assert its mandamus power over the trial court order. If it shouldn't, then that leaves the trial court order in place. But where does the power come from?
Yes. Well, we believe it lacked that power. I mean, the Court of Appeals and Glazers rely on this court's decision in the Frice case. We've argued in our briefs that that's distinguishable, and that obviously is an issue that this court will have to decide. But I think that if this court concludes that the Court of Appeals lacked mandamus jurisdiction as well as appellate jurisdiction, then the appropriate resolution would be to vacate and not reach the merits.
So the question is, did they have mandamus jurisdiction or not, and why?
Correct.
Well, would you answer that?
Your Honor.
Give us your reasoning.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe they did not have mandamus jurisdiction.
Okay, why?
Because Glazers has an adequate remedy at law by way of the normal route for challenging an arbitration proceeding. The Frice case, which Glazers relies on and allows mandamus relief to a party who was challenging an order compelling arbitration, we believe is distinguishable. Because in that case, this court noted that it was a case under the Federal Arbitration Act, and had the case been pending in federal court, immediate appellate review would have been available because, under the rationale of the federal statute and the federal case precedent which this court cited, when a trial court orders the entire case to arbitration, leaving no claims pending in the trial court. Everything's been sent to arbitration to be resolved. That's, in effect, a final order and can be immediately reviewed. However, under the Federal Act in federal court, that is not true when, as here, only certain claims have been referred to arbitration. In those circumstances, neither appeal nor mandamus is available in federal court, and by analogy, the same result should be appropriate, should be required here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents. I'm Neil Clarkins.
May it please the court, Mr. Alan Greenspan will present argument to the real party interest.
May it please this honorable court, I want to address three issues today, some of which already have been raised. First of all, Glazer's common law cause of action for breach of contract has been abrogated either directly or indirectly by Section 102.74 of the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Code. Second, Section 102.77B, the mandatory arbitration clause or statute, constitutes an unconstitutional delegation of judicial power. And third, Glazer's did not consent to the arbitration of its common law claim. For that reason,
If you didn't consent to the arbitration of the claims, I take it you mean there's no agreement to arbitrate then?
That's correct.
So the FAA does not apply?
Well, I believe that the FAA applies to any case that evidences a transaction in interstate commerce, which this clearly is.
But concerning an agreement to that would involve an agreement to arbitrate, if there's no agreement to arbitrate, you wouldn't invoke the Act.
Well, it's a difficult question, one that the Court of Appeals wrestled with in connection with our preemption argument. But I think that that one could make two arguments, either that the FAA applies because we have a transaction in interstate commerce, but that there is
but
no
But you're saying that you have an agreement to arbitrate, so I don't understand why you would invoke the FAA then.
Because the FAA applies to interstate commerce and requires a written agreement between the parties.
Assume with me that the FAA does not apply.
All right.
And then only the Texas Arbitration Act applies.
Yeah.
Do we have? Did the Court of Appeals have jurisdiction over your interlocutory appeal?
Well, they dismissed the appeal.
Now I want to know your opinion. Did they have jurisdiction over your interlocutory appeal? What's your position on that?
My position is that they did have jurisdiction on the basis of this court's opinion in a case that escapes you right now. Jack v. Anglin, where this court said that there is appellate jurisdiction whenever there is a grant or denial of a motion to compel arbitration.
And that was dicta.
I don't think it's for me to say that
well,
this court...
Is that contained anywhere in the Texas Arbitration Act,
no,
a right
it's not.
To appeal from interlocutory appeal?
Correct. It is not. And the case in Anglin involved a denial of a motion to compel arbitration. So arguably that was dicta.
So what would be the basis for mandamus relief then?
There was an abuse of discretion, as this court has held in the Fries versus Canales case. Any time a party is compelled to arbitration against its will, it's denied a substantial right to litigate. And
well, why wouldn't there be an adequate remedy on appeal when only a part of the case is going to arbitration and the rest of the case will need to be litigated before it does get reviewed? Why isn't there an adequate remedy on appeal under those circumstances?
Well, I don't think it's an adequate remedy. First of all, I would say that the Fries versus Canales case clearly states that there is mandamus jurisdiction and that numerous courts of appeals have followed that, both under the Federal Arbitration Act and the Texas Arbitration Act. That seems to be the accepted law of the state. I think also this court has held that any time a party is denied constitutional rights, it constitutes immediate and irreparable harm. And in this case, our argument is that we're being denied our right to judicial review.
Has this court ever issued a mandamus relief because somebody was erroneously sent to arbitration?
I'm sorry.
Have we ever issued mandamus relief on the grounds that a complaining party was erroneously sent to arbitration?
Yes, in the Fries versus Canales case.
Let me ask you, on the issue of agreement, your argument is that there is not an agreement to arbitrate because the law required you to add a provision to your contract that then requires you to arbitrate. So this was not an agreement. Is that
Well, first of all, we look at the contract itself, which doesn't say anything about arbitration. And therefore, it's pure speculation what the choice of law clause meant. Petitioners argue that that choice of law clause which simply appears in a contract written by a foreign corporation with a Texas corporation, somehow constitutes the voluntary consent to an arbitration provision which we contend is unconstitutional. I should point out that the TABC, which has the unconstitutional arbitration clause, also says it may only be enforced to the extent constitutional. So it is the equivalent of incorporating an unconstitutional act indirectly without express consent to do so. I don't think that that choice of law clause means anything other than the fact that Texas law was to govern this contract.
Well, assuming that the parties were aware of the law governing their contract, can't it be said that they agreed to arbitration because they in fact agreed to the contract that they knew would be subject to arbitration?
I don't believe that that's correct, because I think that a party can recognize the fact that certain aspects of a law might be or are unconstitutional, and that their agreement to be bound by an unconstitutional law doesn't constitute consent.
That would challenge the constitutionality of it, but not the challenge as to whether you agreed to do it.
Right. And I believe that that arbitration clause, I believe that choice of law clause doesn't evidence either way consent to do anything with respect to the arbitration clause of 102.77b. It's pure speculation what the parties had in mind. It's just as conceivable that from Glazer's standpoint they were consenting to the judicial powers clause finding that arbitration provision unconstitutional. It's pure speculation. There's no evidence in the record. And I would also point out that the contracts were drafted by Heineken and Amstel, and they certainly know how to say arbitration if that's indeed what they want. And I don't think that there's any evidence in the record to show that the parties actually knowingly, voluntarily, and expressly agreed to an arbitration statute simply by a general choice of law clause, which refers not only to the laws but also the regulations of the state of Texas.
How is this case different from the Thomas case at the U.S. Supreme Court? First of all, do you agree that the federal and state standards on separation of powers are roughly identical?
Yes, I do.
And then if they are, how do you distinguish that case?
I think that Thomas is distinguishable in a number of ways. First of all, the court noted in that case that the applicants for pesticide registration had specifically agreed to be bound by the arbitration provisions. And that's found on page 105, Supreme Court 3339, where they expressly found that the parties had agreed to it. Second of all, we had a situation in Thomas which is very different from that presented to the court here. In Thomas, the court went to great length to discuss the fact that there were absolutely no common law rights involving the data that was subject to arbitration. The court noted that the patent laws did not cover it, the copyright laws did not cover it, and the common law, trade secret law, would not cover it because once it had been submitted to the government, it became an open record and lost any trade secret protection. The difference, of course, from our case is that we do have a common law cause of action. That's clear, I think, if you look at it in this way. Let's assume there was no Section 102.74. We do have a contract which explicitly says it can only be terminated for good cause upon notice. We could certainly sue on that contract at common law. It would be a common law breach of contract action.
Now, if the statute provided a different standard, you would not be able to enforce that contract as written. You would have to follow the statutory standard.
If the court holds that the common law cause of action is expressly abrogated by Section 102.74, then that contract cause of action would be unenforceable. We would have to go solely by the statute.
So assuming we were to hold that, continue with your distinguishing Thomas.
Well, first of all, it's distinguishable because of the arbitration, express consent to the arbitration. In Thomas, there was no abrogation of the common law. which I think is the crucial element here, that even if the statute, the TABC, eliminates our common law cause of action and replaces it with a statutory cause of action, that statutory cause of action is identical to the common law cause of action. In Thomas, the statutory cause of action was directly opposite to the common law cause of action. There was no common law cause of action because there was no trade secret. Congress came in afterwards and essentially said, even though you don't have any compensable right under the common law, we're going to give you a compensable right with respect to this data. And it was done for the policy reason that they felt that that would result in pesticides being invented and registered.
But if we conclude that the statutory cause of action did supersede the common law, so there is no common law cause of action, and that that does not violate the Texas Open Courts provision, how is the statutory cause of action in Thomas different from this statutory cause of action?
I think it's because of the interaction between the statutory cause of action and the common law cause of action. And the judicial powers clause would then be would come into play to make sure that a common law cause of action wasn't merely eliminated and then subsequently codified in a statute and then referred to a non-judicial entity.
Do you agree with petitioner that the judicial powers clause is more directly implicated when the legislative body sends a matter to the administrative state than it is if the legislative body says parties must go arbitrate with the private arbitrator?
I don't agree with that. There is a separate Texas constitutional provision regarding separation of powers, which would be more implicated in that situation. But here...
But what other power? I mean, what power is invading somebody else's power? And in this instance, if we said, let's take an extreme, well, not so extreme, because a number of states have done it. Let's say medical malpractice cases have to be arbitrated first. That's a traditional common law action for the last 150 years. How is separation of powers implicated there?
Well, again, I don't believe that it's separation of powers. I believe it's the encroachment or the removal of certain powers by the legislature from the judiciary that are traditionally held by the judiciary. And there's a reason why those powers traditionally are held by the judiciary, and it's because the people who wrote the Constitution felt that certain powers ought to be vested in the judiciary.
Well, how is this different than open courts in my hypothetical medical malpractice cases?
Well, first of all, I believe that if we have, and first of all, I believe that this statute does violate open courts as well as judicial powers. I think that the difference is that in a situation where a common law cause of action has been codified and supplanted under the open courts provision, one looks at the rationale of the legislature, whereas in this case, with respect to judicial powers clause, one looks at whether the court had judicial review. And
so, for instance, when the legislature abolished alienation of affections, that may not have violated open courts, because like most courts held, there were societal reasons to do that, but it would violate the judicial powers doctrine. We invented the cause of action, it's ours, it can't be taken away.
I think under the judicial powers clause, it can be taken away, but it can't be taken away and given to somebody else. That's the difference. Here, if the legislature, for example, had said that in contracts between distributors and breweries, they will be terminable at will, regardless of what the contracts say, one would have a open court claim, but one would not have a judicial powers claim. The issue under judicial powers is that the cause of action has been given to somebody else, and in this case, a private party. And I should point out that it's different from the agency situation because, as this court has pointed out numerous times, the delegation to an agency is not a delegation of judicial power. It is a delegation of executive power. And furthermore, than in circumstances where the judiciary has review over the findings made by the agency, that the judicial powers clause is not violated. That, I think, is the distinction.
Let me ask you this. Before this statute was enacted, did most of these distributorship contracts have good cause termination provisions?
I can't answer that. I'm not sure. I don't know. It goes back to 1981.
It strikes me they didn't, because that was one of the reasons for the statute, was to protect these sort of relationships and require good cause. So if that's the case, then aren't you having it both ways? I mean, you're usurping the good cause piece of the statute to help you, and yet you don't want the arbitration piece. I mean, that's where I keep getting circular, is I'm having a hard time distinguishing between the common law and the statutory cause of action. You say they're identical, but you're taking the good cause piece that I think, I just intuitively think that the statute was enacted to put that in there, that wasn't typically part of these agreements. So how do you address that concern?
Well, I would say, first of all, that the parties in this case did execute a contract that says good cause.
Well, that's required by law.
But they didn't have to. They didn't have to enter into any contract with respect to that. They didn't have to say good cause. That was their own decision.
Well, if they'd said nothing, the statute would have imposed good cause.
That's right.
So that's where it seems like we're getting the benefit of the statute either way that you wouldn't have under the common law. And it's hard for me to understand what your common law cause of action would look like otherwise.
Our common law cause of action, if you take 102.74 away, is the right to sue on our contract for termination without good cause and without proper notice.
So with no contract and no statute, you have no claim?
With no contract and no statute, it would be an at-will situation. We have no claim except perhaps some sort of a fraud or promissory estoppel or some other claim. But you would have no contract claim.
By having a contract which parrots the words of the statute, you claim that you can have a cause of action that the legislature then cannot dictate the method of its resolution.
I think that the parties are free to contract, that there was nothing that requires Heineken or Amstel to sign a contract which specifically said it can be terminated on good cause and upon 90 days' notice.
Well, let me ask you about that. Let's suppose you agree that the distributorship was for 5 years and it ended at the end of 5 years. That would not be enforceable under the statute, would it?
That's correct. My recollection of the statute is that once those relationships are instituted, they're only terminable.
So Heineken would lose its right to terminate at the end of 5 years, and you would get the right to be the distributor unless there was good cause for termination.
That's
so
right.
So you don't have a common law cause of action outside the statute on the termination.
Well, I feel that we do, and the way I look at it is to assume that there wasn't a statute.
But there is a statute.
Even with the statute, we do have a contract.
But my example, how could you enforce the five-year clause if you do have a contract and there is a statute?
In that case, the statute had displaced that particular aspect of the contract.
You said a minute ago there's in delegation to agencies or that sort of thing, that's not a delegation of judicial power, it's a delegation of the executive authority. How do you square that with the workers' comp situation, where you had traditional common law claims by employees against employers that are now sent to administrative resolution? Why wasn't that a delegation of judicial power?
I don't know if it's ever been challenged under the Judicial Powers Clause, but my understanding of workers' compensation, which is admittedly very limited, is that there is judicial review.
Very limited.
But nevertheless, there is judicial review of the findings made of the agency, is my understanding. Which I'm sorry to say, is very limited because I'm not a workers' comp.
Well, more review than there would be here. At least there's substantial evidence review, I suppose, in that context.
Right.
At the district court level.
Right. In the arbitration contract context, the district court is not able to look into the evidence, really. The only evidentiary concern is if evidence was completely excluded. But assume that evidence, assuming that it wasn't some gross abuse of power by the arbitrators, then the only thing that the court can look at is what is the award. And there is no oversight at all. The arbitrators could issue a one-sentence award saying Heineken wins or Glazers wins. And there would be simply no way for the district court to review those findings. In fact, the record itself is purely optional. Rules of evidence are purely optional in arbitration.
Mr. Greenspan, sorry to interrupt you, but I was curious about a couple of concepts you were talking about, and I don't know if they're related or not, but you have the issue of arbitration generally is enforceable when the parties agree. So you have this argument. Well, there's no agreement to arbitrate because by law you're required to arbitrate. If this is the arrangement you have, by law you're required to arbitrate, and that's not an agreement. So we have a unique circumstance about the arbitration that's being imposed here. You then, in response to the Chief's question about the difference between open courts and judicial powers, made reference to the judicial power being assigned to a private party. It raises my question. In all of the other assignments of decisions of disputes by the legislature, they generally go to an agency, which would be an executive branch. And we've always talked in these cases in terms of assignment of fact-finding and decisions to these agencies, and we've generally permitted agencies to be assigned that task. And I guess we've always dealt with sort of the open courts provision, I suppose, on how that works. Maybe not judicial powers, but explore a little bit this notion that the parties have been statutorily required to arbitrate, and the assignment of the power of that arbitration has been to a private party as opposed to a government entity. Should that be of the court's concern in a judicial powers analysis?
I think so, and it's because there's a separate clause dealing with separation of powers and the movement of judicial powers over to the legislative or the executive branch, which we are not challenging in this case. What we're challenging is the constitutionality under the Judicial Powers Act, which vests the judicial power in the courts, and it has been taken away from the courts and sent to a private party. Now, this court has held in the Barshop case and in the Flag Redfern case that having an administrative agency which has certain procedural protections built into it, do a preliminary finding of facts, does not constitute a delegation of judicial power. It constitutes a delegation of executive power because the agency is part of the executive branch. And that as long as there is sufficient review from that executive power or from that the use of that executive power to the judicial power, then there's no violation of the Judicial Powers Clause. And I think that that's the situation here, where we have taken, where the legislature has taken the judicial power to determine a common law breach of contract case and delegated it to private arbitrators who have none of the procedural protections that are afforded or required in the agency.
Assume that this is not a delegation of a common law cause of action. Let's assume this is a statutorily created cause of action. Should the court be concerned about the assignment of the resolution of a dispute under that to a private party as opposed to assignment to a governmental entity under the judicial powers provision? I mean, powers to decide disputes to go to the courts. And then we have to resolve if this is a court or an executive branch issue. But should the court be concerned under that provision, the assignment of even a statutorily created cause of action to a private entity for resolution?
Personally, I believe that that's of significant concern because the private party is granted broad discretion and the litigants in that arbitration do not have much in the way of recourse in the event of the abuse of that power. If it's sent to an agency and there's an abuse of that power, then there's always the court that has the power to review that agency finding. And I would liken it to, I think, Powers versus Andrews, in which this case addressed the constitutionality under the Legislative Powers Clause regarding an arbitration where police officers and firefighters could elect to go to a private arbitration service, I'm sorry, could elect to go to an arbitration administered either by the AAA or the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. And the court noted, although it didn't have to address the issue, did note that the FMCS was a governmental agency and perhaps that there would be a different consideration in the event that the statute was found unconstitutional because it was sent to the AAA, it might still be found constitutional since there was a federal agency involved in that. The court didn't reach that issue, but I think it highlighted an important issue, which is delegating these kinds of judicial functions to private individuals.
What if the legislature had created a commissioner of beer distributors and said, okay, this commissioner is going to decide all of these same disputes, good cause, evaluation, and that commissioner's decision can only be set aside for the very same reasons that are enumerated in the Texas Arbitration Act? Would that violate the Judicial Powers Clause?
I think it would if the review was only limited to the same type of review that's available in an arbitration.
Why?
Because the judicial review has been abrogated.
Why is that judicial powers as opposed to separation or due process or some other constitutional provision? There's judicial review, but it's limited.
Right. My understanding of the Judicial Powers Clause is that judicial power may be delegated so long as there's meaningful judicial review and oversight, and that in a situation involving the Texas General Arbitration Act or the same standard, it's not meaningful review because the court cannot look at the evidence, cannot determine whether the findings are based on substantial evidence, and other procedural protections have not been permitted. If I could adjust your hypothetical a little bit, Justice Owens, and the situation being that the legislature created a board of the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission to hear these kinds of disputes subject to the Administrative Practices Act and review by a district court, I don't think I would have a problem with that from the judicial powers aspect.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Yeah, please, the court. I'd like to address a few.
Why?
Because the judicial review has been abrogated.
Why is that judicial powers as opposed to separation or due process or some other constitutional provision? There's judicial review, but it's limited.
Right. My understanding of the Judicial Powers Clause is that judicial power may be delegated so long as there's meaningful judicial review and oversight, and that in a situation involving the Texas General Arbitration Act or the same standard, it's not meaningful review because the court cannot look at the evidence, cannot determine whether the findings are based on substantial evidence, and other procedural protections have not been permitted. If I could adjust your hypothetical a little bit, Justice Owens, and the situation being that the legislature created a board of the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission to hear these kinds of disputes subject to the Administrative Practices Act and review by a district court, I don't think I would have a problem with that from the judicial powers aspect.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Yeah, please, the court. I'd like to address a few brief points that were raised in respondent's argument. In the first place, with respect to the argument that the Glazers makes regarding the alleged abrogation of the common law right, even if you assume, for the sake of argument, that the incorporation of the good cause term into the contract has some separate significance as a matter of common law, and for all the reasons I discussed earlier, we would not concede that. But even if you assume for the sake of argument that that is true, still, under this court's precedence in Subaru and Butneru, there has been no abrogation of any common law cause of action. The fact that the arbitral proceeding could conceivably reach a resolution that would have some sort of preclusive effect on the subsequent common law court analysis of the breach of contract claim.
Conceivably. You say it does.
Well, it might. It depends on how the arbitration proceeding develops and what issues are resolved and so forth.
But if you go there and you win, is there anything left of the case?
Well, they've asserted a number of different claims.
Aren't you going to argue they're all precluded?
Well, depending, again, on what the arbitration panel says, we might...
Well, they say you win.
Yes, Your Honor.
So then are you going to contend that all the other claims are completed?
Well, some... I don't know, because it depends on what the arbitration panel says, but I think some of the claims that are asserted in their petition are less closely related to this one than is the breach of contract claim that purports to rely on the good cause requirement. But
if the arbitrator says you acted with good cause,
yes,
is there anything left of the other side's case?
Well, again, I believe that they have asserted, I'd have to go back and double check.
Well, they've asserted fraud and tortious interference, negligent misrepresentation.
And other violations of the statute.
But if you acted in good cause, you were still fraudulent?
I would think not. But again, they have asserted other allegations regarding pricing and exclusive distributorship provisions. So I mean, certainly we might well take the position that the entire case is precluded, but it just depends on what the arbitration panel says. But again, even if you assume for the sake of argument that is true, and that there is some independent common law claim here based on the good cause requirement, even though that is merely an incorporation of the statute, under this court's decision in Subaru, the fact that a non-judicial body will resolve and with binding effect an element of the common law claim does not constitute an abrogation of the common law claim.
Let's not worry too much about abrogation of common law claim. That ultimately might decide the case. I don't know. But let's look at the judicial powers. The legislature comes along and creates any number of causes of action. Can it, in its authority, delegate the resolution of those disputes to a private party?
I think in the context of a comprehensive regulatory scheme where the legislature is acting pursuant to an express grant of constitutional authority, which is the case here, the legislature can assign specific discrete statutory issues for resolution to a non-judicial tribunal, whether it be administrative or arbitral in nature. And there's no... nothing in the Constitution or in this court's precedents that precludes it from doing so. It's not a delegation of the judicial power. It's the resolution of a statutory issue. That's the reasoning that this court has used in the many cases that are being that are cited in the briefs. That it is not the delegation of the judicial power, and the judicial powers clause and the separation of powers are not implicated.
What if the legislature decided that henceforth we're going to abrogate the employment at will concept, and every employee is entitled to be employed in perpetuity unless they're terminated for good cause. But when you get into dispute about what's good cause, it's all going to go to arbitration. Would that violate the judicial powers clause?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, that's a more extreme example than the very limited legislative enactment we have here. And I suppose because that is not the employment context is not one that is so pervasively regulated as is the regulatory scheme we have, as the context we have here, the alcoholic beverage industry, which is obviously pervasively regulated in all aspects, retail, distribution, and manufacturing. So I think an argument could be made that context is distinguishable. And of course, it would also have to be analyzed under the open courts provision, because there you would. Perhaps, depending on exactly how it works, it might be, could be an abrogation of a common law claim, which we don't have here. But I don't think from a judicial powers context, except for the point I made about the comprehensively regulated nature of the industry here, it's not true there. That would be, I think, the only distinction that might perhaps suggest a different result. With respect to the Thomas case, we submit, contrary to Glazer's argument, that it is squarely on point here. To the extent the parties were agreeing to arbitrate, they were agreeing in precisely the same way that they were agreeing here, which is in order to participate in that industry and in order to register your pesticides, which you must do if you're going to be in the pesticide industry, you must agree to submit this information to the government, and you must agree to submit disputes over the value of the information to arbitration. So if that constitutes an agreement that somehow solves the constitutional problem, so does what we have here. And I would point out that the Supreme Court, in analyzing the separation of powers and judicial power issues in that case, did not in any way suggest that somehow the parties had waived the issue because they had entered into disagreement. They analyzed it precisely as we have suggested we interpret here and concluded that even though the extent of judicial review available under that statute was considerably less than the extent of judicial review available here, the court concluded there was no separation of powers problem, that the amount of review available under the Administrative Procedure Act is not some sort of constitutional minimum, nor do the cases from this court suggest that it is a constitutional minimum either.
The public purpose nature of FIFRA seemed to be dispositive to the Supreme Court. Is that right, or is that an overstatement?
Well, I think that it was the fact that it was a comprehensive regulatory scheme, that Congress was carefully balancing public interest and the rights and remedies to be available under this particular statute, and attempting to strike a balance and achieve an efficient mechanism for resolving these statutory issues was important.
So
to the court.
If it was purely a private contract among widget makers and a regulatory scheme for that, that might come out differently.
Well, again, if there were the same sort of comprehensive regulatory scheme that was present there for pesticides and that is present here for the alcohol beverages.
If widgets would come out differently, then, of course, I'm going to try to see what beer is closer to.
Well, I don't know that. I think beer is clearly closer to pesticides. Beer, I mean, alcohol is heavily regulated. I probably shouldn't say that in precisely that way. But I think in terms of the public interest involved and the need for regulation and the pervasively regulated nature of the industry, it is much closer to the pesticide example than to widgets.
Any other questions? Thank you, Howard.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. We'll take a brief recess.